Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 550, titled Going Native. This program is being recorded on April 30th of the year 2006. At the end of this side, and hopefully the next side as well, I'm going to give you information about other websites, including and especially the Spitfire website, which will contain supplemental information which is increasingly becoming important to the understanding of these programs. Many people have written me or emailed me over the years asking if there are transcripts available. Not quite, but pretty close. I turn each For the Record show into an article-length description with text included so that if the admittedly extraordinarily pedantic format of these broadcasts finds you, is to a certain extent, impenetrable or off-putting, please check out the written descriptions, which are increasingly important for a full assimilation of the For the Record experience, for lack of a better term. Now, we're going to plunge right in with a line of discussion that we've been examining over the last three broadcasts. What we've been looking at is an Underground Reich covert action milieu, which incorporates a number of different, seemingly disparate elements, but elements that have as a uniting thread or as a uniting element participation in or apparent association with the Underground Reich. Many of these elements, as I said, appear to be disparate. We're looking at Buddhist elements associated with the Dalai Lama and his milieu. And again, as we've observed in the For the Records 547 and 548, one should not make the mistake of associating the fascist constructions that have been derived from Tibetan Buddhism with Buddhism as a whole. But certainly the tantric Buddhism of which the Dalai Lama is an exponent has many features of it that lend themselves very well to a fascist construction, which is one of the reasons why the SS were so obsessed with Tibet. It was the SS expeditions to Tibet that led to the association between the Dalai Lama and several SS officers, many of them, well, at least one of whom was a notorious war criminal. And indeed, the Dalai Lama has maintained those associations for the better part of a half century. And as we looked at in For the Record 547 and 548, the Dalai Lama and his Tibetan government in exile have been associated with a milieu that's deeply involved in covert action and specifically promoting the, quote, independence, unquote, of a number of ethnic groups, including and especially Muslim and Turkish minorities or Turkic-speaking minorities in the former Soviet Union and in China. The Dalai Lama in particular has been very active with pan-Turkist and Islamist elements that have been attempting to break off Xinjiang province of China as a separate country. We've looked at that in several broadcasts, and indeed in our last program, we took a look at considerable length at the history of the pan-Turkist movement. We did so because one of the Dalai Lama's close associates and a fellow participant with the Dalai Lama and his milieu in the Unrepresented Nations and Peoples Organization, the UNPO, was a guy named Erkin Alptekin, who along with his father Isa Yusef Alptekin is a key operative not only on behalf of the pan-Turkist movement, but also Erkin Alptekin, a German citizen, by the way, who lives in Germany. Erkin Alptekin had worked for the better part of a quarter of a century with Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, themselves closely associated with the Galen ABN branch of U.S. intelligence, and also German intelligence. In particular, in For the Record 549, we recapitulated some segments of RFAs 14 and 21, and we took a look at Ruzi Nazar, named Nazarov, a Waffen SS officer who had been a member of one of the Turkic-speaking minorities in the former Soviet Union. These groups had been attempting to establish their independence. They became part of the pan-Turkist movement. That was a movement born at the end of World War I after the breakup of the Ottoman Empire, which sought to unite or reunite all of the peoples of Turkic extraction in a vast pan-Turkist state. In particular, emphasis was on the so-called outside Turks, those people of Turkic extraction living outside of Turkey proper in the wake of the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. These elements attempted to establish independence from the former Soviet Union. They then, in an attempt to continue to do so, hooked up with anti-Soviet networks in the pre-World War II period, such as the Promethean League, that we looked at in RFA 14. Then those elements hooked up with Nazi Germany and also to a certain extent with fascist Japan in an attempt to use the Axis powers of World War II as levers to pry their independence from the former Soviet Union and also China. And finally, in the post-World War II / Cold War period, many of these same pan-Turkist elements also hooked up with elements of U.S. intelligence, specifically those elements that were associated with the old Galen spy network and the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. Erik N. Alptekin, it should be noted, worked with Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. That is the same milieu in which Ruzin Azar Slay Nazarov, an individual whose name cropped up in connection with our examination of the Pope shooting, worked. And so hence some of our delving into seemingly obscure or irrelevant history. Now, in considering the Dalai Lama, as I've said before, one wants to avoid parochial interpretations. Just as there's a fascist element in the Buddhist faith, so too there are fascist elements in other religions. And for the purposes of our present discussion, we want to be looking at the Dalai Lama and his association with a pan-Turkist separatist element in Xinjiang province, as well as an Islamist separatist element in Xinjiang province associated with the Wahhabi/Muslim Brotherhood milieu. We want to be looking at the Dalai Lama and his milieu as part of a larger construct. They are but one element in a covert action battalion, so to speak, whose uniting thread appears to be the underground Reich. Now, Erik N. Alptekin, a pan-Turkist, and the Dalai Lama, a tantric Buddhist, have been working in conjunction with Islamist elements in Xinjiang province. And in turn, the reason why we're calling this show Going Native is we appear to be looking at a covert action milieu that is using native peoples as vehicles for covert operations. This is a touchy subject because the causes of many of these native peoples are in and of themselves just. And yet, when we look at who's pulling the strings here, the head of the UNPO is none other than Karl von Habsburg, the heir to the throne of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, married to Francesca Thyssen-Bornemisza, the heiress to the Thyssen-Bornemisza industrial empire. That is one of the key elements of the underground Reich. Indeed, Otto von Habsburg, whom we're going to revisit in this broadcast, is basically a fascist and the father of Karl von Habsburg. He's was a member of the Free Rudolf Hess Society. Rudolf Hess, one of Hitler's deputies. The Habsburgs, like their closely associated House of Liechtenstein associates, are conservative Catholics. And yet, like their associates in the House of Liechtenstein, we see them promoting Islamists, pan-Turkist elements, working with, among others, tantric Buddhists and other things that are a long, long, long way from conservative Catholicism. And it would appear that their championing of the rights of indigenous peoples is actually an attempt to utilize, in a very cynical fashion, these native peoples, many of whom have been sorely abused, as vehicles for covert action, specifically as agitprop tools in order to break up states whose demise this milieu seeks. At the end of this program, we're going to take a look ever so briefly at one of the organizations, one of the native peoples the UNPO is espousing. That is the Lakota Native American nation in the United States. Indeed, the map of the UNPO shows a very large section of the middle United States as the Lakota Territory, and one wonders, this is not to say the Lakota haven't been thoroughly screwed, they have, but one wonders what exactly the Habsburgs are suddenly so in, their associates are so interested in the fate of the Lakota. While I suspect that their interest in the fate of the Lakota is very much like their interest in the fate of the Uyghurs or the pan-Turkist elements, they seek to use them to break up larger states. In this case, a little old country called the United States of America. May sound familiar to some of you. We'll be talking about that at the end of the broadcast. But by way of reuniting with the themes of the earlier programs, we're going to take a look now at the book Sleeping with the Devil by Robert Baer, a former CIA officer and the author of See No Evil. And what we're going to be looking at here is the Basmachi Rebellion in the former Soviet Union in the immediate aftermath of World War I and the Bolshevik Revolution. Now, the Basmachis exemplify the milieu that the Dalai Lama, with which the Dalai Lama is associated. Some of them are doctrinaire Muslim theocrats, and some of them are pan-Turkist. Now, in East Turkestan, there is a secular pan-Turkist independence movement associated with Erkin Alptekin. It overlaps an Islamist separatist milieu, and the Basmachi rebellion in the former Soviet Union in many ways exemplifies how not only the pan-Turkist movement, but also Islamists were early rebellion or early rebels against the former Soviet Union and eventually coalesced into elements that were associated with covert operations in the pre-World War II period, run by European powers in the World War II period, run by the Axis powers, and in the post-World War II period by elements of U.S. and other Western intelligence services in conjunction with the Underground Reich. And I suspect that if this pattern continues, the United States itself will become a victim to this very same going native phenomenon, and we may very well end up like the former Soviet Union, broken up into a bunch of small states. Certainly, I suspect that's what the royal houses of Europe have in mind. Turning now to Robert Baer's Sleeping with the Devil, of the Basmachi Rebellion at the end of World War I, which was both pan-Turkist and to a certain extent Islamist, we read, "The first serious Islamic uprising against the Soviets in Central Asia occurred in 1918. Trading in a czarist for a communist yoke was definitely a bad deal for Central Asia's Muslims. A month after their October 1917 victory far to the north, the Bolsheviks sent a detachment to seize the important regional capital of Tashkent. The new commissars began by requisitioning all the food they could lay their hands on and seizing the cotton crop in the name of the People's Republic. A famine soon followed that would kill as many as a million Central Asians. In February of 1918, Bolshevik troops put down a revolt in the ancient Uzbek caravan city of Kokand, sacking and slaughtering as they went, and the Basmachi revolt was on. While the Bolsheviks were occupied by consolidating their victory elsewhere in the Soviet Union, the uprising spread. Victory followed on victory. At its height, the rebellion counted maybe 20,000 soldiers in its ranks, most of them peasant fighters, all of them Muslims." Parenthetically, I would add, some of them doctrinaire Islamists, some of them pan-Turkist, revanchist separatists. Continuing, "The end, though, seemed foreordained. The communists outnumbered the Basmachi, they had heavy weapons, and after the White Russians were defeated, the rebels got the Reds' full attention. By 1920, the Basmachi had been driven back into the mountains of Tajikistan. That's when Enver Pasha showed up. Turkey's Minister of War during World War I, Enver Pasha, flew to Berlin after the defeat of the Central Powers, and then went to Moscow at Lenin's invitation. Lenin wanted to use the charismatic Turk to draw Central Asia's Muslims into the Soviet fold, but as it turned out, Pasha had a grander vision. A pan-Turkic state that would stretch from the Straits of Bosporus to Mongolia. He was only 32. In February of 1922, Pasha captured Dushanbe, the capital of modern Tajikistan. By the end of spring, he had taken control of virtually all of the emirate of Bukhara. In July 1922, the Soviets were forced to react to Pasha's treachery and sent a division south to stop him. It worked. Enver Pasha was killed in battle on August 4th of that year, but the Basmachi wouldn't be completely snuffed out until 1934. Some of the rebels, it was thought, holed up in the remote mountain valleys of Tajikistan. Most took refuge in Afghanistan. More than a few slipped as far away as Saudi Arabia. Some took up residence in Mecca and became dyed-in-the-wool Wahhabis. So that, again, about the Basmachi Rebellion, which was at one point, to a certain extent, Islamist/Muslim, and which then, later, became pan-Turkist in nature. Now, the elements that we're looking at here in connection with the Basmachi Revolt in the aftermath of World War I that we're going to be looking at in conjunction with the Uyghurs and the covert action milieu in Xinjiang province, which has been actively supported by the Dalai Lama, one wants to remember the concept of the Earth Island. That was a geopolitical concept that German and British geopoliticians focused on in the era of colonialism. The Earth Island, particularly valued by the Germans, was a concept that saw all of the, basically, if you look at a map or a globe, A giant landmass stretching from the Straits of Gibraltar all the way across Europe, encompassing most of the Middle East, the former Soviet Union, India, China, and Pakistan, is one giant landmass. It contains most of the world's landmass, most of the world's population, most of the world's natural resources, including and especially most of the world's petroleum resources, and stretching right across the middle of it, from the Balkans all the way down through what used to be the middle of the what is basically the Middle East, the former Soviet Union, India, Pakistan, and as we see, parts of China, is a large Muslim population. And to dominate the Earth Island, controlling Central Asia was seen as the central thing to control, the central element to control. And that is one of the things that led the German and British geopoliticians, especially the Germans, to try to control that part of the world. What we're going to be looking at next concerns the Uyghurs of China. Now, the Uyghurs are a largely Muslim population, much of which is of Turkic extraction. They are part of Xinjiang province of China. And yet, as we have seen in our past several broadcasts, the Xinjiang province of China has been the focal point of independence movements backed by a number of intelligence services, including, among others, elements of U.S. intelligence historically. It also has received support from Islamist intelligence services, meaning Saudi and Pakistani. And it is this milieu, both the pan-Turkist, relatively secularist separatists in Xinjiang and the Islamists, as well as some of the Dalai Lama's allies in those areas and in, quote, Inner Mongolia, that have been the focal point of what appears to be a covert action milieu aimed at promoting the, quote, independence, unquote, of these native peoples by way of breaking off parts of China and perhaps Russia into, quote, independent, unquote, reed puppet states that will be utilized by corporatists and other elements. One should not fail to note that many of these areas are rich in petroleum. One of those areas is Xinjiang province of China. Reading now from Dollars for Terror by Richard LaBeviere, and this text and its full notation will be in the description for the Record 550. Of the independence movement in Xinjiang, we read, LaBeviere writes, China has not been spared. Xinjiang, southern China, has a population that is 55% Uyghur, a Turkophone Sunni ethnic group. It has been confronted with Islamist violence since the beginning of the 1990s. Created in 1955, Xinjiang, which means new territory, is one of the five autonomous areas of China and is the largest administrative unit of the country. The area is highly strategic at the geopolitical level. Chinese nuclear tests and rocket launches take place at the Lop Nor test grounds, as well as from an economic standpoint, since it abounds in natural wealth, oil, gas, uranium, gold, etc. Against this backdrop, attacks have been proliferated by independence-seeking cliques, all preaching, quote, holy war, unquote. Some are acting in the name of Turkish identity, while others are fighting in the name of Allah, especially in the southern part of the region. As in the rest of Central Asia, in Xinjiang, we are witnessing the rising influence of Wahhabi groups and the increasing proselytism of preachers from Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. By the way, this book was published in French in 1999 and in English in 2000. That's the period we're looking at here. Continuing with LaBeviere's text, traditionally allied with popular China, Pakistan is nevertheless trying to extend its influence to this part of China using the Islamists as it did in Afghanistan. For this reason, Beijing closed the road from Karakoram connecting Xinjiang to Pakistan between 1992 and 1995. Since 1996, the frequency of the incidents has skyrocketed. In February of 1997, riots exploded in Yining, a town of 300,000 inhabitants close to the west of Urumqi near the Kazakh border. This violence has caused 10 deaths, according to Chinese authorities, and the Uyghurs have counted more than 100 victims. Every week in 1998 saw a bombing or an attack with automatic weapons. The region's hotels, airports, and railway stations are in a constant state of alert. In April, Chinese authorities in the vicinity of Yining seized 700 cases of ammunition from Kazakhstan. In September, the secretary of the Xinjiang Communist Party declared that, quote, 19 training camps in which specialists returning from Afghanistan educate young recruits in the techniques of terrorism with the assistance of the Taliban, unquote, were neutralized. In January of 1999, 29 activists implicated in the February 1997 riots were arrested. On February 12th, violent clashes between the police and groups of Uyghur militants wounded several dozen people in Ürümqi. 200 people were arrested. In early March, 10,000 additional soldiers arrived at Yining to beef up security, while in Beijing, the Uyghur Islamist organizations took credit for several bomb attacks. This Asian testbed is supporting the emergence of a new type of radicalism, Sunnite and ideologically conservative. It is supranational in its recruitment and in its ideology. It does not emanate out of scissions in the great Islamist organizations, but from a radicalization of the Afghan Talibans, from their sanctuaries and their ties with small terrorist and mafia groups, marginalized and radicalized by repression, as in Egypt and Algeria, in a context of economic and financial globalization, as well as from the circulation of militants who have lost their territories. The principal characteristic of these networks, except in Central Asia and Egypt, is that they recruit, establish their bases, and act at the margins of the Arab Muslim world. In addition to the Egyptians, Pakistanis, Sudanese, Yemenites, and Filipinos, recently there has been a wave of immigration to Great Britain and the United States. Operations take place in Egypt, certainly in Algeria and Central Asia, but also in the east and south of Africa, in Yemen, Bangladesh, New York, etc. The favorite, quote, holy wars, unquote, are Kashmir, Afghanistan, Chechnya, the Caucasus, and now China. Taking advantage of economic liberalization, many former chiefs of the holy war, unquote, have now transmuted into businessmen. They make up an Islamo-business, unquote, world that has colonies in various sectors: Islamic financial institutions, Islamic garment industries, humanitarian and benevolent organizations, private schools, and so on. As political scientist Olivier Roy says, quote, today's Islamic actors are working for liberalism and against state control, unquote. They represent a globalization of Islam deterritorialized in an approach that has been uncoupled from the Middle East. A striking westernization of Islamism is taking place, or more precisely, of the traditional infrastate networks, tribes, Quran schools, etc., are linking up with worldwide networks that function in an extremely modern way and outside the control of any state authority. This evolution results from a history that began long ago. So as LaBaviere has noted, these elements are working against state control. Many of these Islamist elements are associated with intelligence elements that are pro-globalist, pan-globalist intelligence elements, including what are nominally elements of U.S. intelligence. We'll talk more about that seeming contradiction in the end of the program, because indeed there are elements of what are nominally at least U.S. intelligence that are working with the underground Reich. They are working with the Islamists in areas where Islamist activity is deemed to be useful, such as Chechnya and Xinjiang province of China and others. And yet this should not be misunderstood as viewing simply the Islamist movement and the Muslim Brotherhood offshoots such as Al-Qaeda, Hamas, etc., as, quote, U.S., unquote, creations. Rather, as Mark Twain observed, history does not repeat itself, but it often rhymes. Just as the Axis powers of World War II were a very real threat to the United States, militarily and politically, so too the underground Reich's proxy Islamist warriors are a very real threat as well. And yet, there were corporate and political elements in the United States that actively worked with fascists, whom they viewed as useful for a variety of reasons, primarily as investment partners and as anti-communist cadre, And those elements, the treasonous elements, the pro-fascist elements, the fifth column elements, as I talk about in the descriptions to the many old anti-fascist books online, they were working against the interests of the United States. At the end of this discussion, when we take a look at the UNPO's championing of the Lakota cause, again, the UNPO run by the Habsburgs, championing the Islamists and the pan-Turkist separatists in Xinjiang province, the same elements that work with the Dalai Lama's crew, they are promoting the interests of the Lakota in the central United States. The Lakota have indeed been abused, but the Habsburgs and the elements we're looking at are not pro-humanist. They're not pro-rights. Rather, they are using these abused native peoples as cadre for breaking up larger elements into smaller elements, and in the case of Xinjiang province and Chechnya and other parts of the former Soviet Union, these are elements that are rich in natural resources, and having some small Islamist or pan-Turkist separatist group succeed could simply turn those resources over to larger corporate interests and will further the interests of globalization. By the way, when one sees the word liberalization used here by LaBeviere, as in his quote here, as political scientist Olivier Roy says, today's Islamic actors are working for liberalism and against state control. This does not mean traditional American liberalism, but rather laissez-faire economics, the global application of which is globalization. And by way of serving as a transition to part two of this program, we're going to recapitulate an article that we read in the last program. This is an article by Wayne Madsen from Counterpunch, the Alexander Coburn newsletter from August 29th of 2002. This is an article in which shows that Wayne Madsen, to a certain extent, just doesn't get it. Because for once, State Department did something right. On August 27th, Deputy Secretary of State Richard Arnold, this is called Bush's Bizarro World, skipping down. On August 27th, Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage, a shadowy ex-Special Forces officer who has been linked to everything from heroin smuggling in Burma's Golden Triangle to smuggling weapons to the Iranian regime of Ayatollah Khomeini, met with senior Chinese officials in Beijing. According to Reuters, Armitage, representing the world's second-largest totalitarian regime, told the leadership of the world's largest one that the State Department had added a new group to its list of foreign terrorist organizations. The movement seeking independence for western China's Xinjiang region, an area that Chinese Uyghur Muslims regard as East Turkestan or Uyghurstan. The only problem with this designation, obviously designed to please the Chinese regime prior to the upcoming October summit in Washington between Chinese Vice President Hu Jintao, by the way, he's now president, and President Bush, is that the new, quote, terrorist group, unquote, is a member of the same non-government organization as the Dalai Lama's Tibetan Government in Exile, the Unrepresented Nations and Peoples Organization, or UNPO, officially recognized by the United Nations as an international human rights organization. Skipping down. In fact, Erkin Alptekin, East Turkestan's exiled leader, serves as Secretary General of UNPO and thus represents the Dalai Lama and other ethnic and tribal leaders of 52 members of the organization. The director of UNPO, hardly a terrorist, is Karl von Habsburg of the former Austro-Hungarian royal family. And by the way, married to Francesca Thyssen-Bornemisza, as we've seen in several programs. Now, increasingly, the use of supplemental websites is important to a gain full benefit of the For the Record experience. www.spitfirelist.com. That's the Spitfire website, the CD and duplication service that stocks all of the programs and lectures that I've done over the years. I turn every For the Record show into a long article-length description so you can read all about it. Often, there is material in those descriptions that were not included in the original broadcast. In addition to the Spitfire website and the For the Record section in particular, there are linked websites for WFMU, which is archiving all the For the Record shows on Real Audio, and other websites as well with a wealth of documentation. There's also a page to click on for people to support the work that I'm doing, and if you don't like what you're hearing, there's no better way than doing something about it than supporting the work that I'm doing. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 550, Going Native, being recorded on April 30th of 2006. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.